And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. Started out with Alice Coltrane with Atomic Peace from a monastic trio. So the theme of this is peace in schools, a conference that they are putting on coming up in a few days on July 12th. Called Mindfulness, Trauma, and Interpersonal Healing in Education. It'll be a conversation with Dr. Dan Siegel, Dr. Sarah King, and Kaveri Morgan, and moderated and with a presentation of research by Gia Naranjo Rivera. I've got three of those presenters here in the studio with me this morning. And so I'm going to introduce them. Dr. Sarah King is a mother, a UCLA-trained education philosopher, political scientist, critical theorist, and neuroscientist who is now actually in Portland. She is beginning a postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Neurology at Oregon Health Sciences University. Begun that. I guess you started that this fall. These things are sometimes a little out of date. She's an internationally recognized thought leader in the field of mindfulness and social justice in schools and enjoys public speaking and advocacy work at the intersection of those fields. She has also founded Mind Heart Consulting, which is a company dedicated to creating cutting-edge research projects and community healing experiences through the science of social justice, which is something she will talk about, a framework she developed that uses the power of an intersectional understanding of the biopsychosocial impact of systemic oppression. That's a mouthful. I hope you'll help us unpack that. On marginalized populations combined with the application of the science of well-being to understand how to create research and healing projects that serve the aims of social justice in underrepresented communities. Kaveri Morgan is the founder and guiding teacher of welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So people can get your voice there. Kaveri Morgan is the founder and guiding teacher of Peace in Schools, a nonprofit which created the nation's first four-credit mindfulness class in public schools. Right here in Portland she is, as well as Presence Collective, a nonprofit dedicated to igniting personal transformation and collective awakening. She's been practicing mindfulness since 1995, including 8 years in a monastic setting. And before starting Peace in School, she worked with people with special needs. And you can read the full bio at the link on our program page at Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.FM. Just follow the green letters and you'll find all this information. Okay, Gia, good morning, Kaveri.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. Really glad to be here. And I believe that link takes one to Peace in Schools. Folks are welcome to check out kaverimorgan.org as well for more information about Presence Collective.
Okay, I neglected that.
No problem. Thank you.
Gia Naranjo Rivera is a PhD candidate in public health at the Johns Hopkins University. Maybe that's old by now. Or no,
That's correct.
Here, let's
yeah,
go.
That's correct.
The Johns Hopkins School of Public Health with a focus on child and adolescent development, health equity, trauma, and translational research, which you'll probably explain to us. Growing up in a low-income trauma and adversity-affected family and community fueled her passion to ameliorate suffering and promote thriving. And she has directed programs for at-risk youth, advanced human rights in the U.S. and abroad, served as a public health analyst at the National Institutes of Health, conducted health equity research, and more. Again, you can get the full link. So this, I got to give a nod to Joe Clement, who actually turned me on to this event and suggested, knowing that I cover mental health issues on the which I should say, usually on the first Wednesday, everything's pushed up a week this month, you should know, because that's why you're not hearing my regular second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, because, for one thing, I had a bike accident just before New Year's that kind of put me out of commission. And it was also New Year's, and I didn't think I'd be able to get all these guests. So anyway, all that said, let me just read a little bit this so you get a sense. Youth in our nation are experiencing unprecedented levels of stress, anxiety, depression, violence, and trauma. And this is from the Peace in Schools page. We recognize the relationship between these crises and the history of inequity, systemic oppression, and institutionalized racism that destroys our social fabric. Youth feel these deep injustices in their bodies, minds, and hearts, undermining their ability to experience healthy, supportive, and loving relationships. Mindfulness, when taught with the intention of supporting social justice in schools, can give rise to healing, compassion, empathy, altruism, healthy relationships, and a wise heart. It can create empowered social climates and cultures within school, within which students can thrive and experience safety and true belonging with one another. That sounds incredible, especially, you know, when one of the things we tend to hear so much about is these terrible school shootings. It's which I've covered on the show. It's amazing to know that there's. I mean, it's heartening to know that there's a systematic alternative approach to, you know, instead of just sort of casting our kids out in this very competitive, violent, and stressful society. Without the tools, that there are people are actually focusing on that. So, Caberly, talk about Peace in Schools and how that came about.
Thank you. Peace in Schools came about extremely organically. When we began, I was fortunate enough to have Principal Brian Chittard over at Wilson High School recognize that there wasn't a program that supported wellness or well-being in the school. And unfortunately, there had been school suicides that left him painfully clear about the need. So the program started as an after-school program. And then, again, just to give a shout-out to Brian Chittard, he had the vision to stand behind an experiment, a pilot program, of having a class, a semester-long class, which I don't think at the time I realized how radical that was, that it was that we know of to date. The first experiment of its kind, and one of the things that makes it unique is that we're now in 90% of the Portland public high schools, this Mindful Studies course.
And since when? When did that
start? The first class was in 2014. So we're now in it's really been an incredible experience of growth. And one of the things that's been most beautiful about it is we've never run out to push our program anywhere. We've followed a scaling model of that we like to refer to as a pull model. So it speaks to the need in the same way that this event that I'm involved with these gals and Dr. Dan Siegel is something that once we saw this, the Revolution Hall sell out, we realized, oh, we're tapping into something that's of interest to people on a very deep, deep level. And that's why I think we're talking about this being the beginning of a series of what we hope to create together. So Peace in Schools, following this pull model, has just been asked to expand year after year. And at this point, we've served thousands of teens with our program, as well as have developed an educator training program so that educators, youth-serving professionals in Portland can get more skills for their classrooms as well as for their own personal lives.
So is it more than trying to develop these tools that you're talking about within the teachers, or do you also bring in outside, you know, people who are well-versed and well-practiced in mindfulness to the schools?
Yeah, the way Peace in Schools works is that we have a model where a Peace in Schools teacher is paired with a Portland Public School employee for each classroom. And speaking of being trauma-informed, one of the incredible things about that is that it allows for the presence, because many difficult things might arise in the context of class, and you'll hear from a moment from Gia, who's done research about the curriculum. As people who come to see the class witness, many different difficult things might arise for a student, and having two teachers allows one teacher to potentially ground the classroom while another meets with the student privately in the hall if needed. But the model is for the peace and schools person to be the expert mindfulness teacher, if you will, and the PPS teacher, while may have quite a bit of experience in mindfulness, is really mostly responsible for bringing in some mindful movement and then helping with the other logistics of the class. So it's a beautiful partnership.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine that our listeners, by and large, already have a pretty good idea of what mindfulness is, but we have kind of started talking about without maybe explaining it a little more in depth. So maybe when we turn to Gia, you could just sort of give us a thumbnail description of mindfulness.
Sure. Hi, welcome. Buenos dias a todos. Good morning, all. I would love to give a brief description of mindfulness. What is interesting is there isn't one specific definition of mindfulness, and much mindfulness practice draws from Eastern traditions, and I think it's important to honor the history and lineage of where these practices come from. There are also many indigenous cultures that are regularly practicing in mindful ways. I would briefly say that mindfulness is both a set of practices but also a way of being. As the teens at Peace and Schools say, here and now with kindness, meaning bringing the attention or awareness into the present moment, and there are many ways to do that, with a sense of non-judgment around whatever is arising, whether that's experiences in the body, thoughts, or emotions. And if my colleagues want to add anything in that regard, that would be fine. Many of these practices were brought into a more mainstream, as we call, Western context, or primarily in the United States and Europe, and popularized with Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn in the 1980s. But it's important to recognize that many others brought Eastern traditions earlier than that. But that's really where we see what we would consider the modern boom of mindfulness in our United States context, for example.
And you mean the term itself, mindfulness, or?
I would say the popular use of mindfulness, okay. And also the use of the application of mindfulness with folks who are struggling with resistant depression, anxiety, and it was really an attempt to secularize or remove many of the religious implications of some of the Eastern teachings, and applying that often in medical or health and well-being contexts. Now, there are many flavors and variants from that time point, but I think that's an appropriate brief synopsis. Did you all want to add anything else?
Yeah, I thought that was an incredible description, Gia. Absolutely spot on, and I just so appreciated the way that you were able to introduce that with such succinctness and brevity, because there's so much that we can say. But I really appreciate the fact that you mentioned the secularization process. That's absolutely essential to note. And one of the reasons why, and what we mean by secularization, is that a lot of the spiritually oriented language and or references to deities was specifically taken out of these practices because there was a lot of fear within Western settings, particularly within medical and clinical establishments, and most definitely inside of schools, that mindfulness, the practice and teaching of mindfulness, included some sort of proselytization process wherein students or patients were going to be inducted into some form of practice of Hinduism or Buddhism. And there was definitely some sort of negative association or connotation around that. And that was why Jon Kabat-Zinn, I was actually in a panel conversation with him a number of months ago, and he spoke about the manner in which he has been occasionally vilified by members of the Buddhist community that are non-Western because of the fact that he took this step to secularize their practices, which had, I think, the unintended effect of, for some people, stripping away mindfulness from its roots, from its cultural origins. And so I think that would be the one thing that I'd like to mention about secularization, because I think that there's the possibility that that there may have been some harm done in that process, and that that's something that could be explored at a later point.
In terms of maybe like the leaving aside some of the ethical framework, is that?
Yeah, actually, yes. Leaving aside a part of the ethical framework, but also I think that there was perhaps an unintentional whitewashing that occurred. And then this has become linked to just a general sort of description of mindfulness within the broader media and portrayal of mindfulness as being a practice that is really belonging to Western European and white-identified Buddhist practitioners within the United States, which is really a horrible travesty, because then we don't really get to get into the to celebrate the cultural and honor the cultural roots of these practices, which is incredibly important, as Gia mentioned.
Yeah. And I would also add that it sometimes can feel to young people of color that maybe these practices aren't for them, when in fact people from all backgrounds and walks of life can benefit. So that would be a little bit of the negative consequence of the process that Sarah was talking about.
Exactly. I would concur with that.
Yeah, no, I just want to, I'm really, this is really a important conversation. It's new to me, actually, that this whole orientation, so I'm really glad you're able to come on, because these are some of the issues that I personally have had with. There's this new book called Mindfulness, which we can talk about later. I want to get more into the specific event that's coming up, but just sort of to flag that there's a lot of issues around the kind of this stripped down sort of almost a corporate sort of approach to it, or sort of a business-like or transactional, I guess that's the word, transactional approach to it. This sort of come to sort of dominate. There's now there's apps, for mindfulness that everybody, you can just, as you were saying before, Sarah, that you can, there's scientists now who say you can just strip it down, you can, within seconds you can be in this any place, anytime. Anyway, I'll just flag that.
Right, a lot more to be said about that. Definitely.
You
so much
to go on with that, Kimberly?
Well, I just wanted to give a shout out for how I think that has what has been spoken to so far has really shaped why we do what we do through our organization. We don't teach, our main focus, I should say, is on continuing to cultivate deep experiences that have breadth as well as depth. So we're with the same set of teens for over 75 hours in one semester. That's 10 times the amount. Actually, Gia, you probably have the actual statistic of how many times the amount.
Yeah, so on average, an average mindfulness program would be somewhere between 8 and 16 hours, which would be 1 to 2 hours for an 8-week session on average. And so depending on the numbers you use, it could be more than 8 times an average mindfulness program.
And that's significant to us because it allows specifically for a relational context in which the tools, the contemplative technologies that we offer arise. So we can speak more about this environment of care if you wish, but I did want to plant the seed that there are ways to recognize what's been named and then work with it, right? Not to throw out, we just shouldn't be doing mindfulness at all. Not that that's being suggested, but I think one of the things that the three of us have in common is, given the complexity, given the capacity for harm, given the ways in which mindfulness could even be experienced as trauma-inducing for some, how can we really focus on the benefit that can come from practice, and what has to be in place in order for that benefit to come to the forefront of experience?
Well, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Roland. My co-host, Reggie Lee, opted out for today, since partly because we've got a full panel here already. But we look forward to welcoming him back next month. I'm not sure what the theme is going to be. Again, this is usually the second Wednesday is my native co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. We pushed everything ahead a week this month, so schedule is a little changed. And let me just reintroduce my guests. I have Dr. Sarah King, who is started this fall a postdoctoral fellowship at the Department of Neurology. She's going to be speaking along with my other two guests and Dr. Daniel Siegel at an event this July 12th. What day of the week is that?
Sunday,
yeah. July 12th.
January 12th, yeah.
January 12th. And I've also got Kavli Morgan, who's the founder and guiding teacher of Peace in Schools, which is organizing this event, and Gia Naranjo Rivera, who's a PhD candidate in public health at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and will be presenting some research on mindfulness and many of the aspects that we're talking about here at that event. And the event is actually sold out, I understand, but maybe we could talk about that in a minute as well. I haven't given out the number. This is a call-in show, 503-231-8187. Get your calls in early. Don't wait till the last minute. You know how that goes. But it looks like we've already got a caller, Sean. So let's go to him. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
It must have been about 20 years ago now. The cover of Monthly Review magazine had an article by Richard Levins, and he asked the question, "Is capitalism a disease?" And he basically uses public health statistics to lay this all out. There was a wonderful documentary called Unnatural Causes, Is Inequality Making Us Sick? And in there, they make the point that economic inequality leads to things like high blood pressure, your stress hormones being completely out of whack, and that the equivalent of a 747 crashing every day with all people on board being killed is basically that's essentially what's happening in our society because of economic inequality. Joe Clement on the Old Mill Variety Hour actually interviewed Ronald Purser, the author of McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality. And so I'm a little perplexed that Joe would suggest your guest today, because it seems to me that mindfulness is, there's nothing different about it from like the philosophy of like Ayn Rand or Jordan Peterson, because it all can be reduced to this. It's all about individualizing social problems. So it's like a hyper-individualistic thing to teach people to blame themselves rather than act collectively, to get involved collectively. It's the opposite of a Marxist class consciousness approach. It's hyper-individualizing social problems, and I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
I really appreciate the fact that you have called in with this response. Because I think it allows us a really wonderful opportunity to dig into some of the specificities and complexities behind the mindfulness practice, and particularly some of the ways in which there are various notions about mindfulness that are being spread and popularized perhaps within the media that I hope that I can maybe clear up, and perhaps my Kavli and Gia may be able to add a little something to this. So typically when people see a photograph of a person practicing mindfulness, whether this be on a cover of a magazine or wherever you might find it, you see an individual person who is sitting down on a meditation cushion practicing by themselves. Now, you have to note that one of the things that Gia said when she attempted to delineate a definition of mindfulness was that mindfulness is about paying attention in the present moment with compassionate and non-judgmental awareness. And so right there, I just really wanted to note that this idea that you would be sitting down on a cushion and somehow blaming yourself for all of the ills that are happening in society is actually the exact opposite of the intention of the mindfulness practice. And the other thing that I'd like to say is that, you know, you mentioned Ayn Rand and capitalism and sort of this like individualist bent. And I would like to say that the tradition of Ayn Rand is an ideology that is actually, and capitalism itself is an ideology and a practice that is absolutely fundamentally rooted within white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. And so in saying that, we also mentioned that mindfulness comes from Eastern traditions, specifically Southeast Asian and Indian traditions, where white supremacist capitalist patriarchy did not stem from. This is a European creation. And so to make this relationship, to infer that somehow the mindfulness practice comes from or is rooted within this particular ideological perspective and capitalism, which I must absolutely emphasize, was created on the subjugation of people of color, and most specifically was created in order to proliferate the transatlantic slave trade, the enslavement of Black African bodies, and that is truly the inception of the creation of this country and its founding fathers and its ideology. So whereas I think that it's exceptionally important to bring up the fact that yes, from the point of view of myself, just speaking as a scientist right now and thinking about health disparities definitely 100% disproportionately affect and impact marginalized people in the United States and around the world. And what do I mean by marginalized people? Typically, we are referring to groups of people of color and individuals within the LGBTQIA community and other people who have never had access to the privileges and benefits and protections that white supremacist capitalist patriarchy has afforded. And so I don't know if my other guests have something to say about this, but one of the things that I'd like to mention is, lastly, is that when practicing mindfulness, it is never, ever about just directing this energy of non-judgment and compassion towards yourself. Absolutely essential to this practice is that we then examine inside of our hearts how we may then offer up this energy of non-judgment and of compassion and of gratitude out into our societies and into the world. This is a very deeply engaged social practice, and that's something that I would definitely like to put out there to all of our listeners in this moment.
And if I may make one more brief comment, I really deeply appreciate that profound explication, Sarah. And for those interested in this a dialogue around these topics, I think the upcoming event is a strong opportunity to do that, as well as to bring this conversation into your own communities. I also wanted to emphasize that in conducting my dissertation research around peace in schools, I was deeply interested in the ways in which these disadvantaged groups may be engaging with the class or not. And what we do see is that low-income groups, people of color, LGBTQ plus community, and even non-US born students are disproportionately opting into the program, which is really interesting. In addition, we looked at both the positive outcomes of the class and saw things like, reductions in anxiety, depression, increased coping skills, and we were looking at that in an individual level. But I also examined what was going on in terms of process. So how are you getting these outcomes and cultivating a deep sense of community? What's called the environment of care in Peace in Schools language was a fundamental element that is contributing to these benefits for all students, and some additional benefits for certain students of color. For example, improvements in anxiety that were greater among students with higher levels of trauma who tend to be students of color, as an example.
Well, you know, I've talked about, I had my own experience with extreme anxiety about 10 years ago, and I got to say, it was called insight meditation, which I think comes out of the traditions you're talking about. It saved my ass.
Yeah,
I'll just say that. It was, I was unmoored, and I've got all the privileges and advantages, and I can imagine, it's hard to imagine, but kids growing up in difficult situations, it's really nice to hear that there's people who create, because creating space, it's all about creating space and time,
right?
Because to me, I just had no space and time to deal with what I was going through, so that it enabled me. So anyway, we've got three callers, but anybody want to?
Oh, I was just going to add space, time, and an experience of belonging. Yeah,
and I'd just like to add one other point, and this is coming from the dissertation research that I conducted at UCLA. I was actually looking at a mindfulness meditation and yoga program that was being implemented in a school on the East Coast. It had 98% students that were from first-generation immigrant backgrounds, all students of color. And one of the things that I found from this research project was that when we are taking mindfulness and yoga interventions and placing them in schools where students are on a very daily basis encountering systemic racism and gang violence and threats to their nutrition and health. And also, these students, even though they were only in sixth grade, they're incredibly politically conscious and socially conscious. They know exactly what's going on in the world and the kinds of dangers it is that they face. When we teach mindfulness in a way that doesn't allow specifically for the space for students to articulate in a critical fashion, well, what is my positionality in the world? And how can I utilize these practices to be empowered to create change in my communities? Then we actually do face the possibility that mindfulness could bring about an even deeper state of trauma within these students. And so I actually think that our caller did have a good point in that mindfulness, when taught without a focus on social justice or any kind of recognition around marginalization and positionality, can be to the detriment of students in our schools.
And I'm going to get deeper into that and what you call the science of social justice, which seems to inform certainly your work, Sarah, and a lot of what we're talking about. But we've got a full slate of callers that I'd like to get to. The first one, who is, I believe, Camilo. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. I'd like to identify myself and sort of take a position in this discussion. First of all, I'm African American. Second of all, I'm a retired psychiatrist. And thirdly, a social justice activist. And finally, a practicing Buddhist.
Mm.
So
welcome.
I think I fit into this context. And I will only comment on the last call to say that I think it's unfortunate that having a very narrow perspective leads to the problem of when you have only that narrow perspective, you see everything in terms of it, and it really mm-hmm. limits your understanding and availability of information.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But my question is maybe tangentially related to this. It has to do with what you said earlier about secularization. I wonder whether there isn't some sacrifice of the benefits of spirituality, sacredness, the philosophical aspects that Buddhism has in the practice of meditation. And I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the answer to the question is. I don't have any theories, but I suspect that something may be lost when secularization happens.
This is Caverly, and I want to first thank you so much for for your voice, for speaking up, for being here with us. Really value what you're saying. And as someone who practiced in a silent Zen Buddhist monastery for 8 years before founding this program, I just want to echo, I'm with you. One of the things that's been extremely important to me about what we're creating is that we do look at what it means to bring an experience of reverence into the classroom. And that reverence is something that it's been critical to me not be lost in the process, but very specifically, a type of reverence that is accessible to all. It's been really profoundly impactful to me that students of mine who are Muslim have resonated equally with the quality of sacredness and reverence that gets created in a classroom as my Christian students, as my students who might come from a home that has no religious context at all. For some of my students, the environment of care, which stands for confidentiality, acceptance, reverence, and empathy, is the most sacred space they've ever actually tasted. It's a space where we talk about seeing each other essence to essence. And what's important to me about the word secular is, and I want to acknowledge, I think we don't have the right word for what can be sacred and reverent, but not necessary and not stripped of that, but also accessible to all, also not specifically Christian or even specifically Buddhist. So one person interviewing me once said, "So do you think you're teaching stealth Buddhism?" And I think we're really not. We're teaching students to find out what's real and true and to live from a place of authenticity and to have a curiosity around who they really are, which is radical in these times. So, just wanted to say I'm with you, and I think there's a middle way.
Absolutely. If I may add just something very briefly to that, this is Sarah speaking, and you know, I just really would love to take this time to really, from a heartfelt place, thank you for calling in and for introducing yourself and making yourself known. It's incredibly important, your voice. And then I'd also just like to add that, the invention of the educational and scholastic system in this country was really a tool that was developed not only for socialization, but for the control of the hearts and the minds of the youth of this nation. I think that there is sort of a long-seated fear that is had around the general sort of energetic quality that the youth have. They're really, there's something about them where they are not bound to the usual social norms and the ways in which we have been taught that we ought to conform in order to belong to a society that is fundamentally sick. And in that way, they pose a very specific existential threat to society as it stands. So for them to enter into a classroom in which the majority of the locus of the educational activities is mandated to be based upon the cognitive, cognition, everything within the head. Knowledge is located within the head, and we're going to judge you based on what you produce from the head, and then to be taught practices of mindfulness, which say, actually, everything that you need to know, all of your truth is located within the heart. That you can reside within the heart, and that there is incredible empowerment waiting inside of the heart and the body. That is something that is a true revolution in education, and something that I just wanted to definitely mention.
Indeed. And then, could talk about it is a tool of colonization and the, stripping of native youth and putting them in boarding schools as being a paradigmatic example of that. And then all, children who come from different social backgrounds who get, the whole Americanization melting pot. Anyway, we could go off on that in many directions.
Yeah.
But, to respect our callers, we still have two waiting. Let's go quickly to Mike. Are you still there with us, Mike?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I've thoroughly appreciated the discussion and your response from a cultural standpoint and from sort of a societal standpoint about individual versus collective. And I think this goes to the mental health system in general, which seems to be in lockstep with the individual standpoint and is so antithetical to what mental health really is. I have trouble with the label mental health at all in the industry, because it's not. And individual diagnoses need to be replaced with cultural diagnoses. And we are continually just putting it on the individual. And I think we can be effective, and we can start with the mental health system itself. And the mindfulness and yoga types of programs that are coming into mental health systems are starting to create conversations within the systems that are pretty uncomfortable and bring up a lot of denial. And the system is generally being maintained, but I think we really need to, on an organizational level, confront the mental health system as being completely illegitimate, and it has nothing to do with mental health. It's all about maintaining our system until the perspectives of other cultures start blending with the dominant ones.
Yeah. Yeah, so thank you so much for that perspective, Mike. If I can try to briefly respond here, one of the things, Gia speaking, that I find most important about what we're seeing with this program and how it interacts with the mental health system, in quotes, at large, is that the focus is on well-being in a more comprehensive manner. And if I were to take a public health lens, I actually would categorize this intervention, the Peace in Schools program, as both primary, secondary, and tertiary intervention. And what that means is that primary prevention is this upstream, universal, with benefits for all type of intervention to promote and enhance well-being before there are any specific problems, let's say a mental health problem or manifestation. And then secondary, in which would be with folks who are already starting to have some challenges. Maybe they have anxiety presenting, or they've experienced some trauma. And we know that at least 2/3 of folks in the United States report having at least one ACE, which is an adverse childhood experience, such as abuse or neglect. There are also community level factors and macro level factors that are considered these ACEs, like discrimination or historical traumas, and those compound. And so this also is an intervention that can meet those students where they are, as well as a tertiary prevention, which is maybe you're already having negative side effects like using drinking or other unhealthy behaviors to cope with some of these challenges. And so to me, I think there's an element of meeting folks where they are along a prevention spectrum that really gets that's starting to point toward and move toward a more comprehensive, holistic approach to well-being. And then there's also an element of multi-level interventions that are really important. We see within the science that for youth, interventions that don't only target the individual, but also nest them within family and within the within their community, their schools and institutions, is very vital. And you could think of that as like babushka dolls. So the child might be the littlest one, but then you've got these nests moving outward, the family, the community, the various spheres in which they operate. And so to have this multi-level approach and scaffolding is really vital. And we see this with the Peace in Schools program, and that family programs are now being offered. There's an educator training and other facets. And this really starts getting at healing the collective nervous system, not just the nervous systems and traumas of the individuals.
I would like to have Kaberly continue with that in terms of like specific outcomes. We had talked early before the show about a big interest of mine is, you know, the use of psychotropic drugs, especially in younger and younger people, is just a scandal that I think in some ways almost outweighs the opioid scandal going on. And there's at least anecdotal evidence that these programs are actually possibly helping wean kids off those and possibly prevent suicide. I'd like to explore more about that and, again, the event itself coming up on July 12th. But we have a couple more callers. Let's just first go to Candace. Go ahead, Candace.
Good morning. I just wanted to say thank you to Gia for uplifting the origins of mindfulness. I just wanted to note that I'm in a program here at Oregon Health and Science University called the WAIS Post-Bac Program, and it's a program that's preparing Indigenous students, Native students from across the nation to go into medical school. And as a part of that program, we have two parts of it that focus on mindfulness. One is sort of an Indigenous-focused or Indigenous-centered portion, and then the other one is like academic skills and wellness, where we have folks from the OHSU wellness program come and share with us, and we go through exercises together as a collective group of students. And to just to say like how significant that is for many of us, we haven't had any experience with mindfulness or wellness type work. Like I grew up in the 90s, I don't remember anything similar to like the peace in schools, being able to have that as a tool, as a protective factor, especially growing up on a tribal reservation, and the just the significance of that, especially as we go into graduate education. And I think there's a portion of you that sort of gets lost sometimes, especially in the graduate system, where you kind of feel like you can't like walk in both worlds without losing parts of yourself. So mm-hmm. I think this is super important, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And I would just offer that I believe, as a grad student myself, I am in a unique perspective to speak to walking in both worlds. And in terms of my positionality, I identify as Afro-Cuban, Indigenous, and white. And so navigating those spaces can be really challenging. And I have also found myself throughout my academic career gravitating toward yoga and mindfulness before this was ever a focal area of my research. And it was later on that I was making these deeper connections that there may be something profoundly healing individually and collectively, not only from the engaging the practices themselves, but in starting to, as I say for myself, re-indigenize or re-establish connection with systemically severed ties with some of these Indigenous practices in my own heritage. So I'm grateful to hear that OHSU has that program.
Absolutely. And Candace, this is Sarah speaking right now. I actually had a quick question for you. Is per any chance, have you been working with Dr. Jeff Prohl at OHSU?
Yeah. Actually, Dr. Prohl has come into our Friday sessions on Indigenous and academic wellness and shared with us on some of his work. And I know that his transition to Brown, he still comes back and shares with us. And it's been impactful in so many ways, especially as an Indigenous person himself.
Well, that's absolutely amazing to hear, because he is colleagues with Caverly and myself, and he's actually 100% the reason why I'm at OHSU right now. He's the person who reached out to me about the job in the neurology department, and he's been an incredible advocate in my life. And, you know, since I'm at OHSU myself, I just wanted to offer up that I'm sure that myself and Gia and perhaps Caverly at some point, we would love to, you know, just make ourselves available in some way to work with your student group. I think that you're absolutely trailblazers, and my heart is just like swelling up so much with the fact that we had the chance to engage with you on the phone today and to hear about the wonderful work that you're doing. And I just wanted to offer up as much like encouragement and love and gratitude for you being in that space. And to also say that I hadn't necessarily identified myself in terms of my own cultural background. I identify as African American, Native American, Irish and Palestinian. And so when you're a multicultural person who is navigating the graduate terrain, and particularly in a community that is still in process, shall I say, in terms of how they're engaging with diverse populations, and there's still a lot of harm, a lot of microaggressions and macroaggressions that are constantly occurring within the graduate level community, it's very important to have community members who are in positions of power to help back you up. And I'd like to say that we're there to do that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling. Well, we've got another caller, but there's so many things we haven't gotten to. Maybe we could just, if Linda, you could just perhaps make a brief question or point, and then we could round out the show.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for letting me on. My point is I really think that it should be, if you're putting it in the schools, you better stay secular, because you're going to get squashed if you don't keep it secular. I think it needs to be, you need to lead students to the place and then trust that where they go from there, not push Buddhism or Christianity or anything else. Trust the students when you guide them there, that trust that they will go where they need to go. I would really fear the religious right squashing your program. I am sorry to have to say that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling. So I want to, I really want to talk about the science of social justice, Sarah, but I also really want to hear more about this, the event, because it is sold out, but say something about that. Is there still opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's so important that we do get a chance to hear a little bit about the science of social justice. And I just want to express to the community that this is going to be one of many offerings that we'll be putting together, the three of us, in collaboration potentially with Dan Siegel or other experts in the field. So there is a waiting list that you can find on our website.
Yes, the program is sold out at this time. However, if you can go to the events page on the peaceinschools.org link, and there will be a place where you can sign up for the waiting list. And those on the wait list will be the first to be notified if tickets do become available due to cancellations, which may happen in the next few days here.
Okay. Well, as we go, tell us a little about the sorry to kind of cram it at the last minute, but that phrase really intrigued me. It seems to speak to what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the most succinct definition that I can offer about the science of social justice is it makes the rather bold assertion that well-being and social justice are one and the same. And I'll say that one more time. Well-being and social justice are one and the same. We cannot have one without the other. And it also makes the assertion that one of the most profound ways in which we can come to understand for ourselves what well-being is, which is actually within the scientific community a conversation that is still ongoing. What is well-being, and how do we come to a society in which we can sustain the kinds of interpersonal relationships, as well as a relationship inside of ourselves that is representative of social justice? It says that contemplative practices are absolutely key to understanding this, because without the specific body-oriented cultivation of self-awareness that is grounded within compassion and gratitude and a deep appreciation for the fact that we can't keep this compassion and this gratitude and all the other benefits of mindfulness to ourselves, that we can create a natural cycle wherein, as we are increasing our self-awareness of what it is that makes us ill inside of ourselves and within society, that we will then be spurred towards a new direction of creativity and community building in which we can gather together to do some really revolutionary problem solving.
Well done. And of course, you know, one can go off, and since, you know, you're into in the neurology field, that the whole neuroscience of this is really fascinating, and there's been a lot of really interesting work on that, but we can't go in that direction right now because we are basically out of time. So I just want to thank all three of you so much. This is a wonderfully interesting and a bit of a surprise to me, and a good one. So thank you so much, Dr. Sarah King, Kaverly Morgan, and Gia Naranjo Rivera.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And maybe we can do this again. And again, you said there's going to be other opportunities for this sort of event.
There will be.
And you're all three in Portland, which is great.
Absolutely.
Really great.
Yeah.
And looks like we got all our callers in, so I don't have to apologize to anybody. I wasn't able to get in. But again, thanks a lot for being here. And thank you all for listening. And I'll be back talking to you in a week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.